Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 12th, 1996. In the Creekside Room this evening, our speaker is Jim Farrell. Today, he will be continuing his series on moral ecology. Today's session number is 10 and is titled Shopping, the Moral Ecology of Consumption. Let's listen in.
Us to shop, and I think, yes, I will. I think, in fact, what we need to do is do what I've talked about several times here, kind of honest accounting. Can we figure out what the real cost of things is, and then shop according to those criteria, rather than doing the impulse thing that we normally do when we go shopping? And I'll talk. Tonight, I'm not going to talk about supermarkets, although my wife is a wholesale grocery company. And so she sometimes brings home trade journals for me to read. I get to read Progressive Grocer and Supermarket News. And each copy of Progressive Grocer has a store layout in it with a detailed explanation of exactly why everything is the way it is to get you to buy a zillion numbers of things. 70% of purchases in a supermarket are impulse purchases. 70%.
Men or women?
Doesn't make any difference. The only thing that makes a difference is if you go with a list and stay to the list. But most people who go with a list figure, I've got the list, now I'm safe. And they still do about 70% of impulse purchases.
Right, don't go hungry.
So anyway, the conclusion of this, in conclusion, actually I should say start the tape.
Then say right. Let's do it.
In conclusion, the two things I'll suggest are, one, shop carefully and think about the social consequences of your shopping, the moral ecology of making a particular purchase. That's what part of what I've been contending in all of the things that I've been suggesting. And the second is be more materialistic. And what I mean by that is not what we mostly mean by materialism. What I mean is pay attention to the nature of materials and value those materials so that I think in fact Americans are materialistic in the kind of conventional sense that we talk about, but in fact we're really lousy at sort of preserving materials. Right. We just simply discard them and throw them out. And I have a statistic in what I was reading today that suggests that Americans generate 120 gallons of sewage a day. And 3 pounds of garbage, and I forget how much other stuff we generate, but these are the kinds of productions that we make because so much of what goes on in our society is so ephemeral. That's the conclusion. I once gave a talk at a school function where I said that there were 10 reasons for something in no particular order, and then I started with seven, and four, and three. Really confused people. I won't do that to you. Is it okay if I sit? Lisa, you will let me know if you can't hear me. Shopping is one of the primary leisure activities of Americans. Americans go to shopping centers more religiously than they attend religious services, more than once a week. They spend 6 hours a week at various kinds of shopping. Only television watching has increased faster than shopping among activities since mid-century. For teenagers, the mall has become a second home, as the average teenager spends more time in malls than in any other place than home or school. In a 1987 survey, 93% of teenage girls listed shopping as their favorite activity. And this gender typing lasts beyond teenage years as well. 67% of shopping center users are female. Shopping is etymologically the process of going to shops to purchase goods and services. A shop is, according to Webster, a small retail store. The word comes from a root that denoted the booths or stalls in the marketplace. And it's interesting that's the root, because a lot of really good shopping centers now are trying to replicate the feel of the marketplace. They're called festival marketplaces. Except for the one thing that was true in the original marketplaces is not there, and that was that everything was bargained for in the original marketplaces, and both the consumer and the person who was selling it knew a lot about the product. Now we tend as consumers not to know very much about the product, and we have to pay a fixed price for it. Shopping, the word shop became a verb in the late 18th century and a way of life in the late 20th century. In contemporary society, shopping is an activity designed to dispense with the productions of modern manufacturing. And I think that's seriously the case. They make a lot of stuff, and shopping is what they do to get rid of it, or what we do to help them get rid of it. When most things were literally manufactured comes from roots that means made by hand, for people who had ordered them ready-made. So, for example, if you wanted a pair of shoes, you'd go to John the Shoemaker and say, I need a pair of shoes. He'd measure your foot, he'd make you a pair of shoes. That was the way it worked. Society didn't need shoppers in those days because you could order stuff. But once mass production began, the production of shoppers was necessary for the continuation of production. So I want to contend that manufacturers have to manufacture, first of all, the product, and then, secondly, the shoppers. The two things have to go on at the same time. If people didn't shop, businesses would fail. Indeed, the shopper is an essential cog in the wheel of modern life, which revolves around the axle of commerce. At the turn of the century, when mass production made possible the proliferation of objects, it was about 1900, the captains of industry decided that they needed to become captains of consciousness, guiding consumers to the purchase of commodities they produced. In Stuart Ewen's book, Captains of Consciousness, he shows how corporate advertisers reshaped the American consciousness from virtues of frugality and simplicity. I mean, saving was, you read any novel of the late 19th century, a kind of Horatio Alger novel. First thing a Horatio Alger hero does when he gets a dime is save it. First thing my 13-year-old does when he gets a dime is to figure out where can I spend this thing. And that's the sort of revolution in attitudes that's occurred in 100 years. A shift from virtues of frugality and simplicity to a new ethic of mass consumption. Within a capitalist system of supply and demand, the advertisers would supply the demand for products. And that's really important. I mean, we talk about supply and demand, but we act as if it's sort of some kind of neutral thing that's going on. But in fact, demand is supplied by advertisers who get us to want the things that they're selling. Advertising suggests, and part of what I want to suggest here at the beginning, is that shopping is a mental activity, and it occurs first in our head, and then it occurs in places like the supermarket or the shopping center. Advertising suggests that, like magic, a word often explicitly used in ads for cleaning products, this thing cleans like magic, the purchase of a commodity will give us power over the natural and social worlds. When you go home, or when you go back to your rooms tonight to watch television, watch the ads real carefully. You don't have a TV in your room, so that, oh darn.
I like to use this as an illustration for contemporary miracle stories.
Right. Because
you have exactly about the same amount of time, and that's where we have the miracle story, the equivalent of the ancient one in the Bible or whatever.
Right. We believe in miracles, and what's really interesting to me is that we think that we're a rational people, and yet there's a tremendous amount of superstitiousness that goes on. Yeah. In American society, and you can see a lot of it in ads. And ads give you just a tremendous amount of information about American society. All kinds of ads suggest, you can watch for this in ads, power over the natural and social world. So for example, brush my teeth with, what's the one that would get me more and more girls?
Ultra Bright.
Ultra Bright, that was it. Tried it, didn't work. This is something I'm going to talk about in a minute, too, the sort of ultimate disappointment of most of what you buy. And that's important. It needs to disappoint you. Otherwise, you wouldn't buy some more. You wouldn't buy more things. So the sort of cycle of disappointment is real important. Anyway, the advertisers use a social language of class and space. And they do this, sort of, again, pay attention in ads to the class and space cues that you're given. Jeff's from the Southwest. Lots of ads occur in the Southwest because that's kind of an exotic location. And so the sense that you can get to an exotic location with this commodity that you've got, this dish rag, for example, is an associative kind of thing. And it's supposed to make you feel like you can conquer nature and get to the Southwest with this dish rag, although that's not been successful for me either. Actually, dish rags is not what it usually is in the Southwest. It's more often cars, right, and things like that. But there's a language of class and space that goes on in advertisers. John Goss calls this a vast array of cliched signs of real and fictitious elsewheres. We almost never want to see a product in the spaces that we occupy. We want to see products in spaces that are different from what we occupy. So, for example, if we got a kitchen product, we want to see it in a kitchen that's clean, unlike our kitchen, which is all cluttered up with mail on the counters and things like that. Or we want to see it in some exotic location, like San Francisco or Paris, or on top of a mountain where it could never have gotten without a helicopter, you know, all of those kinds of things. The cliched signs of real and fictitious elsewhere. So the advertiser makes the product make meanings for us. And this is real important. Often these imaginative associations are more important than the product itself. Image value is more important than use value. And I mentioned in a talk the other day that this is particularly true for things like beer, where consumers cannot tell, usually, the taste of their own beer from some other beer, which is why beer manufacturers can do these taste tests on TV, because people really can't taste their beer. What they buy is the associations, you know. In fact, we were up at Holden Lake today. Or no, we were sitting about halfway up to Holden Lake. We stopped to sit at the whole sweep of the valley. And I was with Bruce Berner, and he said, "It looks so good, it could be a beer commercial." This is what American advertising has done to us, is that the real world now gets collapsed into the advertising world for us. By featuring the object in its preternatural powers, advertising helps us forget the power structures that produce the commodity. And this is a real important thing about advertising. Somewhere, often in the third world, and if you were to look at all the tags on the clothes that you have on, likely you would find something that's made in the third world. Somewhere, often in the third world, someone, often underpaid workers, have been organized to manufacture this thing for us. Ads almost never show the power of corporations over governments, especially over other governments, and they hardly ever show the power of corporations over workers or the working conditions of the people who make the products that we enjoy. This is what I clearly call, given the term I've been using a lot, the problem of invisible complexity. I mean, this stuff is just invisible to us. Who would know where our shoes were made and under what conditions? And this is why when this Kathy Lee Gifford thing came up a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, it was so surprising to people. You know, real poor people make these things in sweatshops in places like, was it in Honduras that they would be made for her? This seemed like a surprise. We should know this. This is the sort of complexity that we should be making visible all the time.
Excuse me, I'm up here in Holden. I don't see the news much. I don't know about Kathy.
Kathy Lee Gifford's line of clothing was found to be manufactured by a sweatshop in Honduras that was using child labor, I think.
Kathy didn't know anything about it.
And Kathy didn't know anything about it, and she cried when she found out on TV. Yeah. And said that she cut off that supplier. And then since then, in the next week or so, there were all kinds of associations between different, like JCPenney used a lot of stuff that was coming from sweatshops. So there was all this sort of exposure. Pardon me?
Nike,
right. Nike is one that's been a classic for a long time. If you want to go back into old issues of Harper's Magazine, they did a really beautiful, what are they called, annotations. They annotated the wage, what do you call it when you get your check?
Paycheck
stuff for one of the workers that makes Nike shoes in Indonesia, which is where a lot of them are made. And she, Michael Jordan makes $25 million for advertising them. She makes about 84 cents a day for a 12-hour day, and they're locked in the factory in this place. Okay, so using both illusion and allusion, advertisers decontextualize the object from the real world and recontextualize it in the world of our imaginations. They kind of make it a free-floating thing that can be attractive to us without us having to think about the real world. Okay, now I'm going to talk about a particular place. I want to talk about shopping malls. 55% of America's shopping, retail sales anyway, takes place, and I mean that literally, this is a place I want to talk about, in institutions that we call shopping malls or shopping centers. Now, right after World War II, there were 8 shopping centers in the United States. Since 1987, the United States has had more shopping malls than high schools. In the last 30 years, shopping center space has increased by a factor of 12, and 2,000 centers opened each year between 1986 and 1989. By 1990, there were over 35,000 shopping malls in the United States, with 4.2 billion square feet, that's 151 square miles, of shopping malls of gross leasable space. Their sales totaled $725 billion. These malls have also become tourist attractions. By 1990, Potomac Mills Shopping Mall was the leading tourist attraction in Virginia, which, if you think about it, has lots of other things that you might go to, drawing over 12 million shoppers. 12 million shoppers to a shopping mall is now small potatoes, because the Mall of America in Minnesota is estimated to draw over 40 million a year. the original estimates on the Mall of America would be that they would surpass any other attraction in the United States, including Disney World, with shoppers. And in the first couple of years, they did that. Within 3 weeks, they had 1 million visitors to the mall. And I have had the misfortune of being there on 2 of the 4 busiest days in mall history. I think I've been 4 times, 3 times when relatives have come to town and they all want to see it. You know, there's this big thing up here and I want to see it. But my mother-in-law came over Thanksgiving one time and the only day we could go was on the day of Thanksgiving. There were 250,000 people at the Mall of America.
Do they park all those?
They have 13,000 parking spaces at the mall, and they have overflow lots for big days like that.
How far do you have to walk to actually get to the shopping center?
Not very far. They're stacked shopping. They're stacked parking spaces on the side there. One of the things that I'll talk about later was malls are very, very carefully designed, and mall designers have learned that the average American will not willingly walk more than 600 feet, which is two football fields. And so almost all malls are made in sort of segments of 600 feet. And you can get people to walk farther than that by putting in attractions like in Mall of America. You can put an amusement park or a Legoland or something like that. And if you can catch their eye and sort of draw them to that, that's called a magnet, you can get them to walk farther than 600 feet. And there are all kinds of strategies to get people to walk far in malls because they want you to walk by all the stores. And the sales generated in a mall are directly proportional to the time spent. In 1960, the average time spent in a shopping mall was 20 minutes. The average time now is 3 hours. The average time at the Mall of America is 4 hours. So people spend an incredible amount of time there, and the amount of sales go up. They're losing on me, though, because I've stayed there several hours, and one time I only spent $4.57 on ice cream that my kids wanted. But even so, they've gotten me there several times, and they've gotten me past a whole variety of stores. In an article on the magic of the mall, John Goss contends that malls are designed to disassociate shopping from conspicuous consumption. Essentially what he says, a shopping mall is designed to make you forget that you're shopping. Because when you're not thinking that you're shopping, you're more likely to do more of it. Okay. He claims that designers manufacture the illusion that something else other than mere shopping is going on, while also mediating the materialist relations of mass consumption and disguising the identity and rootedness of the shopping center in the contemporary capitalist social order. So, for example, when you're in a shopping center walking down the hallways, you're very seldom thinking, this place is rooted in the contemporary capitalist order. They've got your mind on something else, and they're usually pretty successful at that. The product is the shopping mall is effectively what he calls a pseudo place that works through spatial strategies of dissemblance and duplicity. Shopping centers work first by appearing to be something else, and he mentions a whole lot of things in his article. And he has several terms for this. He says that the shopping centers operate in terms of myths of elsewhere. So in a way, they operate very much like ads, or what he calls otherwhere-itis, or what he calls the ideology of nostalgia. So that malls pretend to be somewhere else or some other time than the place and time that they actually happen to be. So for example, the early malls, up to the 1960s, gave what he calls a modernistic nostalgia for authentic community, even as, ironically, the mall undermines real community, including idealizations and architectural references to villages and small towns. This was a real popular thing in the early ones, and architectural, especially in early malls. The second set of malls, which begin in the mid-1950s and extend really to the present day, refer to the Galleria of Southern Europe, the sort of glass-enclosed, long hall ways of Southern Europe, Victorian Britain, or New England. It's just sort of interesting. These are the places that we pick. You know, we don't pick sort of Danville, Illinois, which is where there aren't a whole lot of references to that. But we pick sort of exotic places that people have some sort of affection for. That's usually some pastime where there's an idealized sense of community there.
You mean in the name, or sometimes in the name? How they look? A lot of them. I can't.
No, from the outside, the shopping malls are meant to be absolutely nondescript from the outside, yeah. Except at the entrance. Now, Goss uses a really wonderful pun. He says that what goes on there is there to entrance you, And so the entrances are often very, very lively now on very, very dull buildings. Everything on a mall now happens inside because the part of the strategy of the mall is to make you forget that the real world exists. That's why there are no windows in malls. Everything is absolutely enclosed to sort of create its own space, its own lighting, and that sort of thing. And the kinds of references that he's talking about are the references that you see over the individual stores.
Oh, okay.
They're the kind of a uniform kind of thing. You could have roofs like the ones here at Holden with the shingles, what are they called? The cedar shingles
shakes.
And things like that. Shakes. What are those doing inside anyway? Think about that. They're there to make a reference for you, to sort of give you a symbolic space to occupy. But there's no rain inside, so they're not serving any useful sort of purpose there, except for them, because they're making this dissociation for you and making it more likely that you'll spend some money. In the 1980s and 90s, there's been a restoration of festival marketplaces, which I mentioned earlier. And these actually require historical landmarks. You've got to have a historical landmark, and then you restore it to look like a marketplace. And usually those have water exposure, and I'll come back to that later on. Water is real important for shopping malls. But the Quincy Market in Boston was the first of those, and then Faneuil Hall, and then a lot of other cities with waterfronts, especially ones that they wanted to renew, have gone to this festival marketplace kind of thing. They also use what are called softscapes, palms, trees, and shrubs along some sort of foreign street, since Americans are often afraid of their own streets. So you don't want to make a reference to sort of downtown Chicago or many of the streets of Chicago, because people would be afraid to walk in that mall. You make reference to some foreign street where things seem safer. And in a way, what happens in malls is that malls give Americans streets free of weather and pollution and noise and crime and taxes. All they have to do is buy things. Another thing that new malls now have is amusement parks, so that Mall of America has a 7-acre amusement park in the middle of it. And several malls now have amusement parks that go along with them. And that's just sort of, they're starting now to put more and more kinds of attractions in the mall so that they get you in there, and then they presume that you'll be moving around the periphery to other sorts of things. These are all versions of what he calls liminal space, space in which surprising and sometimes unsavory things can happen. So for example, when you think of what a riverfront used to be, or what a seafront used to be, was where the sailors used to hang out. So there was a kind of red light district there, a lot of drinking and things like that. And there are often references to that kinds of activity, but it's an absolutely sanitized version of that liminal activity. So you can feel like you're in an exciting place, but you can know in a mall that you're also in a safe place. And so they try to play that kind of tension very carefully. They like to use a lot of plants and nature in malls. Sometimes the plants are plastic, but it doesn't matter. They just need to look natural. And this is to create exotic contact with commodities. Nature, they found in malls, implies freshness and cleanliness. And nature in malls particularly reinforces a sense of human control and order, and what I would call the culture of nature, that we can keep nature where it belongs. And to some extent, it naturalizes consumption. You're not in a shopping mall, you're in a garden, or you're in an arboretum. There's a really brilliant article by Jennifer Price called Looking for Nature at the Mall. And what she's done is she's done a really thoughtful analysis of how the nature company works. You know, again, here's this thing, it's on the inside of a building that has, if it's like at the Mall of America where there is one, it's in the inside of a building that has 4.2 million space feet of retail space or something like that. And there's not a natural thing in the nature company except some rocks and things like that. They always have a waterfall in the front of it because, again, the water makes you feel natural about it. It's a green space, it's usually dimly lighted so that you feel good going in there. And they, in a way, take nature out of nature, bring it into the mall, and sell it back to you so that you have this feel about nature that you could probably have if you just stayed outside in the first place. But she's real good at thinking that through. Fountains suggest civilized urban space and refinement in malls. And malls also like to use art, not because they're particularly interested in the sort of quality of the art, but because they want the reference to art, because art signifies non-commercial aesthetics and civilized refinement. And so you get this reference to non-commercial stuff in a place that's absolutely commercial. So the non-commercial reference has a purely commercial purpose to it. Shopping centers also involve moving people close to the merchandise. Here the language of developers is really instructive. They speak of, quote, choreographing pedestrian movement, and they're very, very careful about how they set up malls to do this. And some other language that they use, they call some things magnets, and presume that we're just sort of little iron filings sort of being moved around the malls, which in fact happens. They refer to the department stores as anchors and expect that people will be moving between the anchors. They talk about other things as generators to sort of move traffic around. And then attractions, carousels, for example, are a wonderful attraction because they move, they attract the eye. If you see one even more than 600 feet away, you might walk to it. And they have a kind of a feel of childhood innocence to them. So you tend to let down your critical mind, return to that state of childhood innocence, and then be more willing to spend money later on. Is there a question here? No. As I said, they've discovered that people won't walk more than 600 feet, not willingly, and so they have hallways of that length or different things that divide up the space so that you don't feel like you're walking that far. Mall widths are usually around 20 feet so that shoppers can see merchandise on both sides of the mall and maintain a sense of intimacy. When halls are wider, as they are in a place like Mall of America, because people would just be packed like sardines in 20-foot widths. They usually have seats and plants or kiosks to draw people along and to move them closer to the store. So if you have a real wide hallway, the chances are you're going to have something in the middle that won't allow you to occupy that middle space because that middle space is too far away from the merchandise. And the idea is to get you out to the edges to see where the merchandise is displayed. And escalators and glass elevators also move people vertically so that they can see all the shops in the center. And they like to make it very easy for you and very attractive to you to use the escalators and elevators. And they also intentionally make it so that you can't go up one escalator and then just get off it and go to the next escalator. You always have to walk around because they want you to expose to those stores that are there. Now, those are some of the things that we see in the mall. But what we don't see in the mall is almost as important as what we do see in the mall. We generally don't see in most malls minorities, in part because of residential segregation, in part because of security practices. Minorities in malls tend to get harassed a lot more than majorities do in malls. And so malls are seen as a safe place for middle-class Americans because it moves them often away from people that they're afraid of. Teenagers show up at malls, but mall owners do as much as they possibly can to discourage them. They don't like teenagers because teenagers hang around and they kind of menace older people who worry about what teenagers might do to them. I see some teenagers over here who look real menacing. You can see what I mean if you just look over here. And so often what they do when they know they're going to be teenagers in the mall, and teenagers, as I said earlier, hang out there a lot, they create arcades where they hope that the teenagers will hang out, and they marginalize the arcades, so they'll put them off to the ends of the mall so that hopefully the teenagers will stay, quote, in their place. You don't see politics in the mall because many political causes could also offend the sensibility of shoppers and remind them that there's a real world out there.
Although there are malls that have, quote, a social conscience. I mean, at least the mall close to our house every Christmas time will have the Christmas angel type things, you know, where you take something off the tree and you buy it. And of course, buy an item for a poor family.
Right. And you know, malls often allow the Salvation Army to be there. That they like to participate in the charitable service there because that improves their image. They're, again, not seen as not so commercial if the Salvation Army is out there.
On the political front, I'm from Portland, and at least in one of the malls there, they do allow people to set up booths to collect signatures for like ballot initiatives.
Right. They have a very narrow range of what they allow, and it tends to be exactly those kinds of things. You can get signatures for initiatives and things like that. You get signatures to get a candidate's name on the ballot. But in general, they've been held to be private space, and so the developers are allowed to prohibit the kinds of political.
This is what's required by law.
Pardon me?
They have to make a space.
Right, right.
Yeah. And they keep it contained.
They also like to provide spaces often for like nonprofit community organizations to have them in the mall too. But again, this is one strategy of what I would call decontaminating the commercial aspects of it. In fact, if we have time, we'll talk a little bit about Christmas. Santa Claus is the great decontaminator. Santa Claus is the guy who decontaminates a commercial product and makes it sort of fit for the family.
My understanding was that teenagers have a large amount of money to spend.
They do.
So I'm a little surprised at what you say about the malls do not want...
They want them there, but they want them in small enough groups and marginalized enough that they don't threaten the older customers who have even more money than the teenagers. But a lot of stores in malls are designed for teenage taste also. Some of the clothing stores are designed for teenagers. So it's not like they're excluded from the mall in quite the way that I would say minorities often are.
One of the interesting things in our local mall is that they've got a large chessboard with large chessmen, and there's always a big crowd, but it's always men. They're watching two other people play this chess game. I'm convinced that that the men are satisfied to stand around while all their wives go
right.
Shop.
So I was telling somebody earlier on that I was going to be doing this later in the week, and it was a man. He said, "I never even go in. I stay in the car." And I don't care how long she stays in there, but I want anything to do with it. And I'm really kind of an unqualified person to do this because I do a lot of supermarket shopping. I do all of it in our family, but I don't like being in malls and places like that. I'm this sort of person that has one thing in mind. I walk in, I know what store I'm going to. I don't care what it costs because I'm going to a discount store usually. I go to Marshall's or someplace like that. And if I can find any one of what is remotely like what I had in mind, I buy it because I don't want to spend any time there. And so I leave. Now there is a female culture of shopping that has to do with conversation and sociability. That I don't know very much about, and so if some of you know more about that than I do, I'd love to hear about that, because men don't do that, at least not in my circle.
Men are hunters, not shoppers.
Yeah, that may be it. That's right. I just want the quick kill.
Yeah, when I
go there. Okay, other things that you don't see in malls, you don't see usually repair shops, because repair shops would remind us of the transitory nature of commodity satisfaction. You know, the important thing about the mall is to make you think that these things are going to be new forever. You don't generally find very many restrooms in malls because they become teen and drug culture hangouts. You don't find drinking fountains because that would reduce concession sales. You don't find telephones in some malls, in some urban areas, because telephones in malls get used for drug culture. And so there's now many malls that have telephones that only do outgoing calls, something like that. You almost never find clocks in malls. And that, actually, you don't find very many clocks around Holden Village either. I don't wear a watch, and it's real hard to figure out what time it is about half the time around here. Anyway, you don't find clocks because clocks would tell us when we ought to leave. You know, you look at your watch and say, "My God, I've been here an hour and a half. I better get out of here." The idea is to keep you there as long as possible. You don't generally find very many seats in malls, except in restaurants, and you don't find windows because the windows would remind you of the time or the outside world, including the climate, which you miss for the most part. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about a wonderful article that I read by Phyllis Rose called Shopping and Other Spiritual Adventures. And she means this very seriously, shopping and other spiritual adventures. She distinguishes between shopping and buying, contending that shopping serves a variety of needs not necessarily satisfied by a purchase. Critics, she says, take American materialism too materialistically. According to Rose, shopping is a time of reflection, assessment, spiritual self-discipline. I'm not quite sure I'm going to agree with this, but I wanted to try it out. Shopping, she says, has many purposes, the least interesting of which is to acquire new articles. We shop to cheer ourselves up. We shop to practice decision-making. We shop to be useful and productive members of our class and society. We shop to remind ourselves of how much is available to us. We shop to remind ourselves how much is to be striven for. We shop to assert our superiority to the material objects that spread themselves before us. Now, I'm not sure that I agree with all of these, but one of them I do agree with is shopping is therapy. We speak of comfort foods, but each of us also probably has some comfort commodity in our lives, the ones we buy when we are beset by life. So instead of trying to change the structures that beset us, we contribute our change and more to institutions that are generally part of the problem. because advertising works so well, it's true that buying things can cheer us up, because advertising sort of suggests that this is going to happen, and many of us believe that, at least for the first part of the purchase. The social and psychological states that are attached to the merchandise can make us feel better about ourselves. And the novelty of a new purchase can give you a kind of pleasure, because it's new. But it's unusual for that pleasure to last. The new toy becomes old, and as people adapt, as the novelty wears off, pleasure comes to be replaced by comfort. And so we go looking for pleasure again. And this distinction between pleasure and comfort is real important. Comfort is kind of a steady state of being okay and feeling good. Pleasure almost requires discomfort in order for you to have it. So for example, if you work in a place or live in a place that's air conditioned all the time, you have comfort. But you have pleasure if you've been outside for a long time and you come into an air-conditioned place. Or last night I walked down before Vespers to 10 Mile Falls, and it was hot out, and I walked up under 10 Mile Falls where it's really cold and wonderful. That was where I experienced pleasure, but it took the discomfort to get the pleasure, first of all. But it's this way that pleasure wears off and changes into your comfort that leads us back to purchasing again, because we're out hunting, I suppose, for pleasure. Does anybody have any questions at this point? I'm going to shift and talk a little bit about how we think about materialism.
Well, would you agree that people in today, in society, if they're going to buy something, it's probably going to have to wear out eventually or get broken sometime soon so that they can go out and buy another one? They won't get anything that will last forever?
Yeah, things don't last forever. They could last longer than they do. And in some cases, they're designed not to last as long as they might, because manufacturers could wait a long time to replace this replacement. You know, once everybody's got a television set, if they all work and last for 20 years, television manufacturers would be in a sorry state if they didn't break down. And the lack of repair facilities in the United States means that when they break down, often we throw them out and then go out and buy new ones, which is great for General Electric and Magnavox and the people that are making new TVs. But things do break down like that. The important thing to remember, though, is that sometimes when you've got a new thing and then it gets old and you get rid of it, what you've really done is you've contributed to a secondary market of used goods. And it would be good in the United States, I think, to have a better secondary market than we now do. We don't glean the things that would still be usable in a consumer society very well. Salvation Army does that, and Goodwill, and a few places do that. Free stores in a lot of cities do that. But the amount of secondary goods that there are is really extraordinary and could really be put to good use. One kind of secondary market that I'm involved in a lot is garage sales. I'm a garage sale shopper. I like it a lot. Let's see if I have anything on the garage sale. Actually, I got this shirt at a garage sale this year. And that's that's a way of taking something that somebody doesn't want and buying it very cheaply. And so that's a good thing. I think people ought to do more garage sailing. Another thing that Phyllis Rose talks about is window shopping. And she calls that sort of shopping as an art form, because you don't actually buy anything. You just do all that judging and spiritual discipline stuff that she talks about without purchasing anything.
Well, you say garage sale shopping is a good thing, but the fact that people have garage sales allows them to go out and buy some more stuff to fill up that space that they just made room.
Right. I mean, it is all part of a consumption cycle. The consumption cycle, though, can operate with all new goods and just sort of discarding the old ones. And the amount that they get at a garage sale is really quite small compared to the original price of things. My best garage sale purchase of all time was I bought an espresso maker at a garage sale for $4. And so the second time I had espresso, I had paid for it. You know, it was wonderful. And it lasted about 4 or 5 years. And I drink a lot of coffee, so I probably had, in that time, I don't know, 1,500 or 2,000 cups of espresso for $4. Yeah.
It'd be interesting to work in the idea of garage sales as a counter to what you're saying. Because garage sales, the interesting, and we've had two or three of them, no matter what price you put on it, someone wants it for less. I mean, if you had the price of $4 on the espresso machine, fantastic price. Most people would say, okay, just give you $3 for it.
Right, I'm too shy to do that usually.
That's this is one of the few places where we...
It is like the original marketplace.
Yeah, the original marketplace.
People will bargain. Yeah. I do that sometimes on if they have something that's really fairly high priced, like say $10. What I'll do is I'll figure out what days they're open, and then I'll go back near the end of the sale and offer them nothing for it.
But if you have a garage sale and price things too high, people won't even stop. I mean, people will stop and look and go away without. You have to have it. I mean, there's a whole culture
of garage sales. And in fact, some anthropologist has done an ethnography of garage sales, and I haven't seen it yet. But I'll report back some other time when I
need a footnote in there.
Okay, well, let's think about a little bit about how religion fits with this consumer culture that is in shopping malls and things like that. Whether or not we think that our visits to the shopping mall are fully choreographed, we usually come home with things, the particular evidence of our general interest in materialism. In that book I was passing around, God and Mammon in America, Robert Wuthnow tried to figure out how it was possible for one of the most religious nations on earth to be one of the most materialistic nations ever. And if you remember, the very first thing that I did here 2 weeks ago, I said that Americans have used more material goods since 1945 than all other civilizations before that. It's a tremendous amount of materialism here. He found that although religion does exert considerable influence on American economic behavior, it doesn't much affect shopping. Compare the weekly church sermon to the daily preaching of the Church of the Holy Shopper advertising. When people buy a new car or a new dress, how often is the doctrine of stewardship on their minds? Of course, it is the job of advertising and salesmanship to keep it out of their minds. I mean, you don't have very many ads that say, you know, stewardship is an important thing in American religious traditions, therefore buy a Toyota or, you know, whatever it might be. That would be a kind of tension that people wouldn't want to see in an ad, I think. Instead of changing our behavior, Wuthnow found that religion often makes us feel better about the behavior we have. It is often more therapeutic than prophetic. Virtually all Americans, about 3/4, say that materialism is a social problem. 89% agree that our society is much too materialistic. 90% say that children today want too many material things. 75% say that advertising is corrupting our basic values. Americans believe that materialism is a social problem caused by individual selfishness. We worry about materialism because it seems to show self-interest that devalues community and compassion. We tend not to see materialism as the result of social forces, and among the social forces that you might list would be capitalism, laissez-faire economics, commercialism, business practices, profit-seeking, and you can make a very long list of that, but we tend not to see that. And that's, in general, Americans tend to see things individualistically. We tend to ascribe all kinds of intention and guilt to individual actors and not have much understanding at all of what I would call a sociological perspective or a structural perspective. So we see that not as a result of social forces, but as a matter of personal choice. But not, interestingly enough, our personal choice. It's somebody else's. It's a sort of I'm okay, you're not so good syndrome in American culture. But Wuthnow suggests that, ironically, the American public voices concern about the reign of materialism while wandering the corridors of the mall. Somehow we have been able to convince ourselves that materialism is bad for our collective health, but good for our individual health. And so he tries to explore this kind of paradox. So he finds that while Americans who worry about materialism are less likely to value possessions themselves, the differences are really very, very small. And the materialist consensus is pretty broad. 80% of us think that having a high-paying job is important to the good life. 78% think that the importance of a beautiful home, a new car, and other nice things is part of the good life. Others see nice clothes as essential to the good life. 72% agree on the importance of being able to travel for pleasure to interesting places. Restaurants, interestingly enough, are not so essential. Only 50% of us consider eating out at restaurants important. While 86% of American churchgoers think that greed is a sin, 79% of them wish they had more money. And only 30% of them believe that riches get in the way of knowing God. apparently, says Wathnow, the majority of American churchgoers have trouble believing Jesus really meant it when he talked about the difficulties the rich face in reaching the kingdom of God. So how can we sort of explain these inconsistencies? One strategy for resolving the conflicts, and apparently a lot of Wathnow found that a lot of us do that, saying that money is one thing and morals and values are completely separate. So a lot of people would say, yeah, I'm religious and I have moral values and things like that, but they just don't work in the marketplace, and so I don't apply them there. A variation of this strategy is what Wathnow calls the psychologization of money, in which our attitude toward money is emphasized more than our behavior. I can have all these things, we seem to say, as long as my values aren't corrupted. Sometimes we invent what we call our inner self, an interior real self that is uncontaminated by the commercial transactions our outer self engages in. We seem to say that we can have lots of stuff as long as it doesn't corrupt the purity of our inner self by invoking notions of greed or superiority. We don't feel greedy, so we probably aren't. If we don't derive our essential happiness from our material possessions, it's okay to have them. If our possessions don't possess us, then we can probably possess them. A second defense of materialism might be called the I don't spend that much defense. Unlike the it's all subjective explanation, which is essentially individual, this one is essentially social. As Wathnow points out, social norms define reasonable levels of consumption. It is expected, he says, that people will consume automobiles, clothing, housing, and other items at a level consistent with their standing in the community. So essentially what he's saying is there's a social pressure to consume up to your standard of living. When Phyllis Rose says that we shop to be useful members of our class and society, this is what she means. In general, in America, most of us don't think that we're living luxurious lives, because residential segregation usually structures space so that we are among people of our own class. Compared to them, our consumption patterns are not abnormal, and so we're not materialistic, no matter what the level is, because our reference group is the people around us. So keeping up with the Joneses keeps consumption levels high and social conscience low. A third way of thinking about materialism is the I give my money away defense. Since Americans see materialism as selfishness, any sort of generosity, no matter how small, can convince us that we're really not materialistic. So donations to churches or charities offer evidence that we care, and caring people, we assume, can't be materialistic. And so this is a way that we think that we can have the religion and the materialism at the same time. I'm going to stop here for a minute. I have this wonderful poem called I Am Shopping that I'd like to read, but I don't know what time it is.
7:07,
and the people in the tape ministry want me to stop by 7:15 with at least some coherence, so I could do that. If people want to, actually, if they've been listening at all, they know that's not possible. Should I read the poem, or would you like to talk about some of this stuff?
No, read it.
Read the poem? Okay. This is a poem written by a student at St. Olaf in the 1980s when Burnsville Center was the big mall, the big new mall in the area. I am shopping for the essential me, and I am shopping for the American dream at Burnsville Center, and I am shopping for something that is made only in America and not in Japan, and I am shopping for a cowboy hat and boots at the Berman Buckskin store, and I am shopping for an Indian pony at the pet center who can survive smog and automobiles and take me to look for America along Interstate 90, like the pioneers. And I am shopping for the latest self-help book at B. Dalton so I can burn it outside of Burnsville. And I am shopping in the wide open spaces of a three-level shopping center with no windows. And I am shopping for red, white, and blue kites and toilet seats to get a head start on the tricentennial. And I am perpetually shopping for the fulfillment of my American dream. I am shopping for a new hero, and I am shopping for a Bjorn Borg tennis racket and Dorothy Hamill shampoo and hair conditioner. And I am shopping for the number one album on Top 10. And I am shopping for The Secret of Youth and Good Looks at Dayton's Looking Glass Salon. And I am seriously shopping for a jogging suit at the locker room where the clerks are dressed like referees. And I am shopping for the Bible on cassette tape read by Jimmy Carter with Exodus and You Light Up My Life sung in the background by Pat and Debbie Boone. And I am shopping for a car television at Sears so I never have to miss Walter Cronkite or the Fonz. And I am perpetually shopping for the Lancelot of my American dream. I am shopping for the essentials, and I am shopping just to pass the time, and I am shopping with Dad's hard-earned dollars, my pockets full of green power and metal marbles, and I am shopping for a good buy, and I am shopping happily at prices that will get much higher before they drop. And I am shopping for Kool-Aid while the Winona research ladies in blue smocks ask questions about frozen fruit punch. And I am shopping along with hundreds of thousands of other Americans clutching their pocketbooks and shopping bags full of treasures and pleasures. And I am shopping while the poor in pocket become poor in spirit and wait for the kingdom. And I am shopping for garden seeds at Bachman's to plant food for peace. And I am shopping in the house and garden section of Sears for a new lawnmower at bargain prices, but decide to let my lawn return to prairie instead. And I am shopping for a book on Minnesota wildlife in the Boundary Waters so I can remember how it looked before snowmobiles and motorboats. And I am shopping for a cure for the common cold, and I am shopping while thousands of stimuli bombard my senses till I am dazzled and dizzy. I am shopping in the newest, brightest indoor mall in Minnesota, and I am anxiously shopping for the perfect outfit in some obscure boutique to save me from the summer blahs. And I am shopping for a new image, and I am shopping for a bouquet of daisies to offer at the altar of new beginnings. And I am shopping for something to make me smile again. This is all the therapeutic stuff. And I am shopping for a quiet corner to sit down and rest where the Winona research ladies can't find me. Because my feet are aching from walking on cement floors all day. And I am shopping for the record at the record bar on which Jackson Brown is running on empty like me in search of the American dream. I am shopping for a book that maketh all things clear, perhaps Nixon's memoirs. And I am shopping for the answers to all the unanswerable questions, and I am shopping for a poster of Anita Bryant to hang on my door and throw darts at while I sing Onward Christian Soldiers and Blowing in the Wind. And I am shopping for a book about the Holocaust because I want to be prepared for the inevitable annihilation of the white middle class. And I am shopping for hot dogs and donuts, ice cream cones and cokes at the junk food places while an elderly lady in Minneapolis eats dog food. And I am shopping in carpeted stores with pretty colored glass and piped in Muzak to quiet my conscience so I can forget that people suffer in America and not just in South Africa. And I am shopping for rhinestones rather than diamonds. And I am shopping for a solution to the problem with no name and equality and the American dream. I am shopping for sex appeal toothpaste. And I am shopping for black lingerie at Fredericks of Hollywood because it's in vogue this year. The Vogue is the magazine. But Frederick doesn't have sizes smaller than 36D. And I am shopping. And I am shopping for love. But the Beatles said a long time ago that you can't buy it. And I think somebody ought to tell them at Burnsville. And I am shopping for a Memorial Day card with flowery verses at Evenson's Hallmark store because I care enough to send the very best. I am shopping down avenues of phony wood fronts between colored lights and plastic come-ons around obtuse corners and open balconies where I can see from level three to level one. And I am shopping for reminders of home, for misty green river valleys and limestone bluffs. And of these one and all, I weave the song of myself, like Walt Whitman, who is under the soles of the new boots I bought at Tom McCann. And I am shopping for colored tissue paper and crayons, and I am shopping for the perfect present to give my friend Christy. And I am perpetually shopping for undiscovered masterpieces by unknown artists at craft fair tables set up along the mall area. And I am shopping perpetually and forever at Burnsville Center for contentment and the realization of the American dream. It's a great poem. You may know, some of you, that it's a takeoff on a Lawrence Ferlinghetti poem, which I forget the title of now. It's in his book of poetry called The Coney Island of the Mind, and I Am Waiting is the title of his poem, and also a poem that does exactly the same thing that Jennifer does here, what I would call the transvaluation of clichés and the juxtaposition of things that often we don't want to think about. I mean, what she does is simply bring into the mall all of the things that are supposed to be excluded from the mall so that we can shop comfortably.
Is that what you meant by the transvaluation of clichés?
This?
That switching of the use of the clichés to represent.
Yeah.
What did you mean by it?
The transvaluation of clichés is when you... for example, in Lawrence Ferlinghetti's poem, he says he's waiting for someone to make the world safe for anarchy. Everybody knows the phrase is supposed to be to make the world safe for democracy, and he gives you another phrase there. Same rhythm, but different, entirely different meaning. That's the transvaluation of clichés. If you know the book Catch-22, Catch-22 does that also. Terrific use of cliches. And good comedians also are great at the transvaluation of cliches. And what happens there is that people know the commercial cliches so well that they're what, from an earlier session, Randall Jarrell would call the possibility of comprehensible illusion. You can allude to those things, and people will know what they mean, and then you can give them a double meaning by just changing it slightly. It's a sort of a wonderful satirical and critical strategy. So let's turn off the tape now, and then we can be absolutely free in whatever we want to say for a few minutes before we have to go to Vespers.